Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored by Horton's Funeral Services and powered by our partners at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. And that means my super producer out of Motown, golfer extraordinaire. He is Rick Hampton Sr. And folks, this is a very special edition of In the Coach's Corner, because very seldomly do you get a chance to have a visit and a sit down with your mentor. But that's what's going to happen tonight, and I am so excited. And before we bring him on, let's bring him on in an appropriate manner. Rick, you got it queued up for me, brother? I want y'all to listen to this. Yeah, that's the Godfather theme, but it's DC style. Little Chuck Brown with a go-go flavor. Hit it, Chuck. And you're wondering, why are you playing the theme to The Godfather? Because we've got the Godfather of sports talk radio, especially in the DMV. He had classic interviews with sports stars, politicians, and newsmakers of the day. He has been an activist for children's rights well over 50 years, establishing Kids in Trouble. The man who really needs no introduction, he is Harold Bell. Harold, man, welcome in the Coach's Corner, and it is an honor to have you aboard tonight.
Well, thank you, Butch. Thanks for inviting me, man. I can't wait to hear what you got to say.
All right. Well, listen, but before we chop it up, I got to get your thoughts because, man, you've been around sports for a long, long time. And what is your take? We're in such uncharted waters with the pandemic. Major League Baseball tried to get started, and now you see what's happening in Miami with the Marlins. The NFL, they're in camp this week, and I saw a number of the players for the New England Patriots that said, hey, we're opting out. Your thoughts, Harold?
Yeah, six of them opted out, And I said, well, I don't know if you're aware, but I do a Facebook Live show 7 days a week at 9 o'clock on p.m. And one of the things, I just started my show about a couple of months ago. But I said right from the beginning, pro sports should not be played this year. It needs to be set out. It's uncharted waters, just like you say. We have no vaccine. But we have no game plan. They really don't have a game plan. And my thing is this, man, it's the plantation mentality that's taken over because the owners are sending guys back out there, and these guys got families. They got grandfathers, mothers, everybody, man. And why would you go out there and put your life on the line with a pandemic like this so we don't have any idea where it's coming from? And especially, we're talking about guys like the NFL, we're talking about NBA, we're talking about Major League Baseball, we're talking about National Hockey League, even the number one player in professional tennis, Dovacek, came down with the disease. Now, you know, anytime we go together in groups like this where guys are sweating, I just don't understand how they expect to survive, and I was not surprised when the Marlins came up with 8 players, man, that came down with the disease. And it just does not make sense, man. And these are guys that are making millions of dollars. But is it worth your life to put your life on the line to go out there and play? I don't think it is. I heard some guy, he was on Stephen A. Smith a couple of nights ago, days ago, and he said, man, what you really want to test them? Tell the owners to come out to practice, come around the bench, hug you when you come into the stadium, hug you when you leave the stadium, and see whether they show up or not. That'll tell you right there what you need to do. It's no way that these guys should be playing, Butch, because taking a year off, the owners are going to lose money. And that's what it's all about. They don't care about anything but a bill. They're going to be somewhere up in a sky suite watching you out there on the field or up in the mountains with a large screen TV nowhere near you and while you put your life on the line. It just doesn't make sense, Butch.
Hell, I would agree. And the more the games are played in Major League Baseball, and especially with practice now, as we stated, with the NFL, you're going to see more and more players opt out. I mean, here with the Nationals, the best everyday player, the young star, Soto, he tested positive.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan Zimmerman, mm-hmm. the face of the franchise, said, no, I got young
no,
children.
Sir.
I can't go. And
mm-hmm.
how can you argue with someone like that? You know, there's no debate.
No debate, boy. Even Hightower from the New England Patriots said, man, I just had a baby.
Right.
Y'all count me out. I'm saying about six of the New England Patriots, they have opted out from this thing, man. And this will pick up, man, because guys will come to their senses and say, man, it's not worth it. It really is not worth it, man.
Mm-hmm. Now, something more near and dear to your heart than professional sports is high school sports. And a lot of the high school fall sports, such as football, at the best have been pushed back. And I don't even know if, even in December or January, the start time of some leagues that we'll be able to get football in or basketball. Your thoughts on the high school season?
Yeah. I think it's the same thing. We're playing Russian roulette, but this is Russian roulette, man. That's exactly what it is. Because I would understand. You know, I said from the beginning, I'm scared that this thing is airborne. You know, I don't even like to leave the house, and I have to leave the house because I have to go out and get a water, a bread, and that type of thing, man.
Sure.
And to put these kids out there on the field, just like these pro athletes, man, it's Russian roulette. And we're talking about sending little kids back to school where some of these counties and cities are spiking with the disease. You could send elementary school children and put them in these classrooms, and they go carry it back home, and you can see where this pandemic does not have a cut card, Butch. It will affect the whole family. So here we're losing 1,000 people a day right now. 1,000 people a day. I think we're around 150,000 people dead for, I think, close to 400 million or somewhere around there that are infected with disease, the ones that we know. Some people are saying that it's 10 times that because we don't have an effective way of giving the test, Butch. It's scary times, man. It's scary times.
It is very scary times as we continue our conversation with a pioneer, a legend, a D.C. treasure. He is Harold Bell. And, Harold, you once said that your first heroes or sheroes couldn't hit a home run, couldn't catch a touchdown, and couldn't dunk a ball. But they were heroes and sheroes nonetheless. And you mention often your mother and your grandmother. Talk about
the
influence that they had on you.
Well, Butch, there's no doubt about it, man. My grandmother and my mother. See, my mother was 6 months pregnant with me when she went to New York chasing my father. And I was born in Brooklyn, New York. I know nothing about Brooklyn, New York. In Kings County Hospital. And I think My mother stayed up there a year or two and then brought me back here. See, all my brothers, everybody from D.C. I'm a fourth generation Washingtonian, like you said. And my great-grandfather laid the first brick to build Mount Airy Baptist Church at North Capitol and L Street, Northwest,
okay.
in the shadows of the Capitol. So when my mother brought me back to D.C., she found a one-room shack on Douglas Street and right off Kenworth Avenue. And we were in the one-room shack maybe a year. And what happened one morning, my mother thought I was asleep. And I had my dog there named Billy. She could slip out and to the store, corner store, and get some milk and bread, and left the kerosene lamp burning and with us in the shack. Man, when my mother returned home, man, I was out in the yard with my dog standing over me crying and fire engines everywhere. The shack burned down. And the only thing that was left was the outhouse. So my mother took me to my grandmother where my older brother was, Bobby. My father had already left one of us with my grandmother. And I went up to J Street Northeast, and my grandmother raised me, man, until I was about 10 years old. And that was the best thing, man, because they laid the foundation, man. My grandmother, man, she was she sung in the choir. She headed the choir. She played the organ. We were in church, Bush. We were in church 3, 4, maybe sometimes 5 days a week, all day Sunday, man.
Yeah.
And my grandmother laid that foundation because, man, I saw real church, Bush. That was the thing. I saw real church, man. On Sundays, man, it was like a revival every Sunday in Mount Airy Baptist Church. If you didn't get there at 11 o'clock, man, you had no seat. And that means all of us young to get up and get a seat to the seniors, you know. But, man, to hear my grandmother and my aunts and uncles, they made up the choir. They could sing like angels, but then my great uncle, the Reverend Earl Tyler, he could preach like Martin Luther King and sing. And, man, we had a ball in church. And then the foundation was laid during the week, where my grandmother and uncle and would carry some of us around to surgeon quarters to go out and see the sick and people who were shut in or to the hospital. So they laid the foundation for me early. They said, Harold, where'd you get this foundation from? It came from my grandmother, man. It came from my grandmother. She was my hero, man. And Butch, when I left my grandmother to go live with my mother in Parkside, my mother finally, she graduated from Godoza High School, and she was finally able to get a job in the general accounting office downtown. And she was able to apply for housing in Project in Parkside. So 10 years old, I had to leave my grandmother, and I cried like mad. I did not want to leave my grandmother. And boy, she said, get out of here, boy. You can come up here and see me anytime, you know? And I went to Parkside, man, and that laid the foundation. But to make long story short, you know, when I became a so-called a media personality, when I became an outstanding athlete and then went on, like I said, to become a media personality, my grandma called me aside I'll never forget it. And she must have heard me lying about something on radio. You know, must have heard. And she said, son, I want you to understand one thing. Always tell the truth. Because a lie will change a thousand times. The truth never changes. And, Bush, that's how I have lived my whole career. I'm flawed like everybody else. I am not perfect. You know, I tell lies, but, Bush, you don't tell something that's going to hurt somebody else. And I learned that from my grandmother. So that's why I had no cut card when I went on the radio. You know, I went on with Petey Green in 1967. He gave me 5 minutes on the air. And Petey and I used to caddy at Burning Tree Golf Course. So Petey gave me my first break, and I learned up under Petey. And then I was able to move out on my own. Bobby Bennett picked me up as WOL on Saturdays. Then I went on to WOOK with Inside Sports, man. So my heroes have always been women, man, because they have really been my backbone. Even today, my wife, we've been married 52 years now. Butch, yes. As you know, the people, that's a mystery to people who can't understand how she stayed with me for 52 years. But that's it. The backbone, man, has been women. They have been the superstars in my life.
And Harold, before we talk about your magnificent career as an all-around athlete, I want to go back to what you said. You gave us a scenario where you, being a very young child with your dog, mm-hmm. don't remember mm-hmm. how you got out of the burning house.
Don't know how I got out of the burning
house. Okay, but the point here that I want to lead to for our listeners, some may be aware, a lot not, but you mm-hmm. have been anointed to do miraculous things. That was just number one. But talk mm-hmm. about the two events that were to come, where you weren't just a hero, but you were a superhero. Talk about the mm-hmm. event in terms of saving someone in a swimming pool, and then the next event, saving someone off a train track.
That's unbelievable, man. Well, the first event, which was after the 1968 riots, which you're well aware of because you were living mm-hmm. in the area, I
sure.
founded a Kids in Trouble Saturday program. I started my nonprofit organization. I married my wife in November, and we had our first Christmas toy party for needy children at Hillcrest Children Saturday program in 1968. Well, that was a facility that was really there for kids who had emotional problems. They were connected with Children's Hospital, and it was a big, beautiful building, as you know, on that block. But the kids in the neighborhood were not allowed to go in there. They had a swimming pool, man. They had an outdoor basketball court. They
yeah.
had everything. They had sleeping facilities in there. They had like a cafeteria. But the people on community weren't allowed to go in there. So what happened during the riots, looked like the people were attacking that building. And so the director, he wanted to do something. So somebody said, well, you need to contact Harold Bell. And so they called me up for a meeting. And I went there, and they said, Mr. Bell, we'd like for you to come in and, you know, do a program on Saturday, open it up to the community. And at that time, man, I was playing ball on the weekend with the Virginia Sailors. I was making me a nice little paycheck. I wasn't thinking about giving that up. So my wife said, well, let's think about this. You know, let's think about this. So anyway, we ended up going in and opening up the program. And on Saturdays, I would get some of my buddies, my brother Earl, who's a D.C. cop, a friend of my best friend, Andrew Johnson, they would come up and sit in for me on Saturdays. And I remember one Saturday, man, I walked in to the pool. I think the season was over. Yeah, the season was over. It was during the summer. And I walked into the pool, and everybody's in the pool, man. All of a sudden, I walk in, they point down to the bottom of the pool, and there was my little horse laying on the bottom of the pool, man. I said, what? Well, I jumped in there, man. I ain't know nothing about no CPR or nothing else. And pulled him out of the water. And I took Horsey up in my arms and ran soaking wet to Children's Hospital, which is about a block and a half away, man, to save his life. And every time I see him, he's still living. I said, boy, you know, I saved your life. But that was
right.
the first time, Butch, that I saved someone's life. And then years later, 2007, I was on the way into D.C. I was living out in Suitland at the time, and I had to go and get my wife's medicine from CVS drugstore, and I wasn't driving at the time. So I put the subway in and got to Potomac Avenue. It was about 2 o'clock in the evening, so it, you know, like the sub, it wasn't nobody around. And I started walking, going up the escalator, and I saw this little girl lying just lying straight out across the track. I couldn't believe my eyes. So I come off the escalator. I'm getting ready to run and jump onto the tracks. And the brother stopped me. He said, hold it, man. Hold, no. Do it this way. He laid flat down on his stomach. I laid on my stomach. And we tried to get this little girl. She must have been about 14, 15 years old. We hollered, baby, give me your hand. Give me your hand. She wouldn't move. But and then I looked under my stomach, and I saw them lights flashing. I said, oh, my God, a train is on. Train is on the way in here. So my man went over to pull the emergency thing, but it was too late. The train was all the way in. So while he's gone, man, I looked at the little girl. I said, girl, give me your goddamn hand. And she woke up, boy. She woke up and reached up and grabbed my hand, and my brother came over, and we pulled that little girl up, man, just as that train was coming in. man, that was I had broken out in a cold sweat. So now we pulled it off the track. Now the brother who was should have been in the you know that little thing they're supposed to be in with it up at
right.
the top of the steps. He must have gone to the bathroom or somewhere because he didn't see nothing. Now they come down, they call the ambulance thing now. So now they really trying to cover it up. He don't want his bosses to know that he was nowhere around. But what happened, a friend of mine, I don't know if you remember this girl. In fact, when she was at that thing was Dave Bing and Doug Williams, but I gave her I can't think of her name now. But she was the one found out about it and called Channel 4. And Channel 4 came out and did a reenactment. And to this day, I have not been able to find that little girl and that I pulled off the track. They covered that up. So, yeah, I've been in a couple of situations like that, man. But, you know, it's just something that you do, Butch, that you don't think of. You know,
yeah.
You don't think of. How you become a pioneer? You know, we dream about being a pro athlete. We dream about being an entertainer. We dream about being a doctor, lawyer, engineer, chief. You don't dream about being a pioneer. How you going to be a pioneer? Pioneer is somebody that goes something first, something ain't nobody else done. So
right.
You do things that comes from the heart, that's instinct, boy. Just instinct.
That's right. Harold Bell is in the coach's corner. And, Harold, let's talk a little bit about you being an outstanding athlete, playing everything. And, you know, you talked about your mother and your grandmother
mm-hmm.
being your first influences, but on the playground, who were some of the people that influenced you? I mean, of course, you influenced so many of us in the area, but who were your influences and models as it pertained to sports?
Well, it was a guy by the name of Nick Turner, Mr. Brooks, J.D. Matthews,
mm-hmm.
Bethel. All these guys were outstanding teachers and coaches on the playground. Boy, look, we live in a housing project. A lot of us come from broken homes in that family. But you know what? The playgrounds, Butch, were our babysitter. You know, our moms, when they went off or from 9, like school was out, we'd go down to the playground at 10 o'clock, Butch, and wouldn't come back home until it was dark. You understand? The playground was our babysitters, and our parents knew we were safe because of the people, man, that were hitting those recreation departments and running those playgrounds. Like I said, man, we had some dynamite people, man. We really they laid the foundation. And people always talk about a great athlete, man. Come on, I wasn't no great athlete. I know some brothers and sisters, even say some sisters who came out of Parkside would make me look like a chump, man. I mean, some great athletes came out of Parkside. They just didn't get the chance for it. Going to college, they just not got that. They didn't get that chance because, you know, for whatever thing, you know, they got in trouble, they became drug addicts or whatever. But, man, yeah, I know some athletes. Great athletes that came out of Parkside. When I stop and think about some of the guys that came behind me that went on to Spingarn and went on to Phelps and became all high and everything, I think about Cecil Turner, who went on to become a great punt returner and kickoff returner with the Chicago Bears. He followed me. He came off the same block, man. And I think about a potato head. What's that boy's name? I can't think of. About 4 or 5 of them, man. That came out behind me, and Alphonso Lawson went on with he played with the Jets for about a year.
Was Lonnie Perrin?
Some great athletes. Mari Wills come up. Mari Wills came out of there. You know, Mari Wills came out of Parkside.
Oh yeah. Was Lonnie Perrin from that area?
No, Lonnie wasn't that area. Lonnie, I don't know where Lonnie. In fact, Lonnie tuned in the show the other night. I was on. I hollered at him. Lonnie grew up over there by McKinley Tech somewhere. That's where he went to McKinley Tech.
Yeah,
came up over there. Great, and that's a great athlete. Lonnie was a great athlete.
No question. Football and
basketball, man. So when you know, when people talk about great athletes, man, what made me outstanding, Butch, is that I wanted the ball in my hands when the game was on the line.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? I wanted, so that pissed off a lot of my teammates. And some of my coaches, you know, they thought I was selfish, but man, look, when the game was on the line, throw me the ball. You understand? I want to be at bat with the when the winning run on base. I want to take the last shot. That was mine. Not that I was a great athlete, it's just I was a hell of a competitor, and I always thought that I was out there, and I was proven wrong a lot of times. But that was my mental attitude. I carried that same attitude into the playgrounds when I met you guys. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
I went out, and when y'all met me, man, I had nothing but confidence in myself. You understand? And that confidence spilled over to y'all, because you never heard me out there cussing, never saw me shooting crap.
Never.
You ain't never see me drinking or nothing, because
I
knew you guys were watching me, man. I understood that y'all were watching me. So I had to care myself accordingly. Not that I was perfect or flawed. It's just I was aware of what the surroundings and environment that I was in.
Mm-hmm. Now, Howard, tell a funny story, because you were the original Keyshawn Johnson. Just throw me the darn ball. Okay, but tell a story how coaches back then, and back then, of course, you didn't understand, but you understand now. That a coach, you know, what he locked you on the bus, right?
Yeah, man.
Tell
at Spingon, I played everything. I played football, basketball, and baseball. And on the baseball team, I called myself Willie Mays. You know, I went out there and I make basket catches. I had my hat. I run after the ball and my hat come off my head, you know. I stole the bases. I did everything on my own. And when I got kicked off the baseball team, because we were playing Fairmont Heights and the score was like 4-3 in the seventh inning. And I got on base. I was two outs. I stole first. I stole second. I stole third. So Mr. Hill, the coach, called timeout. He had to come over and say, Bell, please, well, we'll stay right here. We got our best hitter up. Donald Malloy, we call him Cornbread. He was a hell of an athlete, too, boy. And I said, okay, coach, before Mr. Hill could get back to the bench, I tried to steal home. I was out by a mile, Butch. I was out by a mile. So we get back to school. Mr. Hill comes down into the locker room. He said, Bell, since you want to be Willie Mays, I'm going to give you a chance to go up to New York and join him. he told me to tear in my uniform. And I did, and the team went to the stadium, man, without me that year. And the guy that replaced me in left field made two errors to lose the game to Wilson, man. And Cornbread never allowed me to forget that I cost them the Inter-High Championship of getting kicked off that team. And Cornbread just got killed a couple of weeks ago in an accident on North Capitol Street, man. But he was a hell of an athlete, man, and a great guy. Next, we move on to basketball. Mr. Roundtree, who was Dave Bing's coach, and Mr. Roundtree, you know, took advantage of my talent, saying I was such a competitor. He did what's called 4-1, you know, where everybody played zone with me, and I played the other team's top four. You understand? Boxing one, yes. So, man, you know, I was good at that, you know. But, Butch, I never see my name in the paper. All I see was the guys who were scoring points in the paper, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So my senior year, I went out, man, all summer. I started shooting that ball, man. I mean, I could put the ball in the basket. I came back my senior year, man, co-captain, and, man, he came back over to boxing one. But, man, I got selfish and started shooting. I messed up a good team. So – he kicked me off, man, in the middle of the season, man, and told me to turn my uniform in. So I said, God, dog, man. So I left, you know, I went on my way. And then football season came, and Coach Brown, my senior year, I'm going to make all met and everything else because I'm catching everything they throw at me. Well, we got to play Phelps. I think we were undefeated, man, and got to play Phelps over at Eastern High School. And so I had Donald Wills was my quarterback. That's Mari Wills' brother. He was a bad brother.
Duck.
He could throw that football, man. Duck Wills, that's right. You know him. So Duck was a hell of an athlete, too. He played football, basketball, and baseball. We come out of Parkside together, so we were boys, man, you know. So we playing Phelps, and at halftime, it's about 30, 40 seconds left, and we down on about the 20-yard line. And so Duck calls the pass to me, and I jump offside and catch the ball for a touchdown. And they call it back. So I'm raising hell with Duck as we heading back to the bus at halftime. I'm giving him the blues, man, because I'm talking about, you know, I couldn't hear what you were saying doing this. And Coach Brown is observing me all the time. So we get on the bus, Butch, and say our prayer, and we come up with both strategies for the second half. And as everybody started off the bus, Coach Brown stood in my way and said, "Holy son, we're going to try to win this one. We'll see you after the game." Locked me on the bus, man. And Doug Wills went out there and returned the punt 63 yards. I'll never forget it. And we beat Phelps. This was our rival. 6-0, man. And I got back to school, man. The bus parked out front. And Mr. Brown said, "Hold it before we get off, everybody. You know, I think Bell wants to apologize." Bell has something he wants to say to you guys. So I know he wants me to come up front and apologize. But I wasn't going to do it. I'm talking shit. So I'm sorry. I'm talking shit. So a guy next to me named Jelly Hansberg, who was tackle, he kicked me, man. He said, "Boy, you better get up there, man. This is you out of here if you don't go up there." My last chance was I jumped up, ran up there, and apologized to everybody. And, of course, went on to have a great year. And that same coach, man, I left Spingarn. I got pissed off, left Spingarn, went to Eastern transfer. And he came and got me, sent me out to Fairmont Heights so I could graduate, man, because I was going to hell in a hurry. There's no doubt about that. And from Fairmont Heights, he sent me down to Big House Gaines. You know what that story is. And Big House Gaines saved me from there. But Dave Brown was my savior at Spingarn High School, and he was the coach for Elton Baylor. And he did the same thing to Elton Baylor. He locked Elton Baylor in the locker room, too. Everybody told me that later.
Now, as we continue, see, that's why I love Hal Bell, because he keeps it real and keeps it raw. And so we're going to continue. And, Harold, let's talk about as a teenager. Now, this is fascinating stuff, and this is stuff that you've had in your book. And before we leave, certainly let our listeners know if they're not aware about your book. But as a teenager, you're working as a caddy at the Burning Tree Country Club, and that's where you meet the then vice president, not of a company, not of a college, but of the United States, Richard Nixon, and you develop a relationship. Take us through that story and developing a relationship with Richard Nixon, a.k.a. Tricky Dick.
Tricky Dick, yeah. Well, like I said, you know, I come out of a housing project, and I was telling you about my mother got that job at the general accounting office, and she was able to apply for a house in the housing project. And one thing I want to say about that housing project, man, we had school teachers, we had doctors living in that project, man. It was one great, great community, man, where we looked out for each other. You understand? We looked out for each other, man. And that was fascinating. So when my mother lost her job at the general accounting office, I don't think she lasted but for 2 years or something like that. Think about the last hire is the first fire. You understand? Mm-hmm. And my mother was a brilliant lady. She was lucky as hell. So she came home, and man, she started selling bootleg liquor, having card games on the weekend, man, and making money, hitting the number. My mother could dream a number one night and hit it the next day, man.
Oh,
I ain't never seen nothing like it. So she would hit the number, man. So and people became very jealous of her because she helped everybody. My mother had a hard boy that was unbelievable. She had a dollar bill and somebody needed 50 cents, they got 50 cents. But people get jealous, man, when they see that kind of success. So what happened, evidently somebody started snitching on my mother. And they started, these cops, man, in the wee hours of the morning started, you know, knocking my door down and taking my mother out in handcuffs, man. You know, me and my brother Earl sitting there on the steps, we crying. And then my mother would always look back and say, "But," she said, "Look, I'd be back in time to make sure you guys are ready for church on Sunday morning." And that's how it went. So one weekend, the cops came in, knocked our door down and everything. And so it was a family across the street named Wall, the Wall family. One of the sisters or brothers would come over and sit with us, you know, until my mother came home the next day. So Jody Wall was one of the sons. Jody was a little older than me, but he kind of took me up on his wing. So he said, man, why don't you come on and go out to Burning Tree with me on the weekend, man, and caddy. Caddy? What the hell are you talking about, caddy? I ain't know about no caddy. So we went out to Burning Tree Golf Course, man. We caught the bus, went out to Westmoreland Circle. That was the end of the line out there. And we stand around that circle and wait for some of the golfers to pick us up who were members of the club. It was an all-white exclusive club. I mean, this is where all the big shots played. The world leaders, man, played out there at Burning Tree. So I went out there. So one of the first things my homeboys told me, said, Harold, look here, I don't care what you do. They know I like to gamble. Look, do not mess with Petey Green. That was Petey Green, you know? They said, look, stay away from Petey Green. So anyway, one Saturday, I go out, and I come in early because we like to travel. There's about five or six of us from Parkside, and we like to travel together because there's a lot of racism going on, man. Mm-hmm. That time, and we like to be with each other, you know, protect each other, you know? So I get in early, and I'm waiting for my homeboys to come. And, I'm getting hands in my pants, you know? I'm walking around, ain't doing nothing. So I say, let me go down here and see what this Petey Green's all about. I went down and there's Petey Green. Petey Green got a crap game going. He got a card game going. And boy, it looked like he smelled me coming. he pulled out the card. Butch, I was broke in 15 minutes or less, Butch. I mean, I was broke, man. I said, oh, my God, man. I don't know what to do. So Peter gave me $2. He said, you know, this is a bus fare. You can get some little tab and hamburgers. And I want my money next week. I want $4 when you come back. Well, he even charged me $1 on $1. So I go back up, Butch. I don't want my homeboys to know that Petey done beat me all my money. So I'm trying to figure out, man, I got to get a ride and get out of here because I don't want to hear that mouth. So I'm going to the parking lot. And as I start toward the parking lot, the pro Max Elvin called me, say, hey, Lil Bell. And I turned around and said, yes, sir. He said, come here. So I go back. He said, look, I got two bags. These guys ain't going to play but 9 holes, you know, and you can make yourself some extra money for the day. I said, okay. So as I take the two bags and start walking toward the tee, I hear somebody say, hey, Harold, are you ready for an adventure? And I turn around, I see these two white guys, and I said, damn, that's the Vice President of the United States. I didn't know who the other guy was. Mm-hmm. I said, yes, sir, I'm ready. Come on, let's go. Just give me the money, man. So, Butch, whew, I found out what he meant was I ready for an adventure. Man, them first 3 holes, his ball stayed in the woods more than the birds and the bees and the squirrels. They were balls everywhere, man. Hey, Butch, it was hot as hell, man. And, man, the sun was still out bright. I'm going in and out of the woods. And Mr. Rogers, he was Attorney General at the time. He was a hell of a golfer, man. And so I go in and out of the woods, man. So now, Butch, we coming up to the 9th hole. And, man, it's almost dark. So I said, well, at least this is the end of the journey. The Vice President hits another ball in the woods. Go in and find that. We come out, and he hollers across the fairway. Hey, Bill, let's go 9 more. I said, oh, my God, he didn't say that. So, Butch, we go 9 more holes, man. And tell you, that was one of the toughest 18 holes I ever been. We got to come in. It is pitch dark. Pitch dark. I can see the lights on in the clubhouse. And he hit his last ball in the woods. He said, okay, Harold, let's go. So we get in. But I'm standing out there. All my homeboys, they done left me. They think I done gone for some reason. Everybody done gone. And I go to the parking lot. Ain't about 4, 5, 6 cars out there. Now, some of the members come in, and they play pinochle. You know, they take a shower, sit down, play pinochle, and relax. So I'm trying to figure out how in the hell I'm going to get home. I'm going to have to wait for the kitchen help and the shoe shine people to come out, take me home. So I'm waiting for somebody to come out and pay me. And the president bounced out of the clubhouse, and he comes over, and he gives me a nice little tip and say, Harry, I'll see you next time. And I said, I hope not. So anyway, I go back to the parking lot, and who comes out but the vice president and Mr. Rogers. And the first thing the vice president said, Harold, you need a ride? I said, yes, sir, I certainly do. So we go to the parking lot, Butch, and I see this limousine, this is like a block long, Butch, black limousine, about a block long. So I said, now during this time, Butch, he ain't had no Secret Service man. You know what I'm saying? Just him and Mr. Rogers. So anyway, Mr. Rogers go, he get in the driver's seat, and the president get in, he drive, you know, in the passenger. And I open up that damn back door, Butch. It looked like, man, a suite, a living room back there. I got back there, man, and Butch, I laid back, man, like driving this daisy, man. Shoot, they would drive me on back into town. And the vice president, he looking at me, he, you know, he kind of smiling. He said, Harold, tell me about yourself, man. Where you live? I said, well, I live in Northeast Washington, sir. I live in a development called Parkside, you know? He said, oh, okay. He said, you got any brothers and sisters? I said, yeah, I got a couple of brothers. And he said, what school you go to? I said, yeah, I go to Spingarn. He said, you play any sports? And what do you say that for, Butch? I stuck my chest out. I said, yes, sir, I play football, basketball, and baseball. And boy, he said, whoa. He said, whoa. And boy, his next question to me, Butch, I almost crawled under the seat. He said, well, tell me about your grades, Harold. I said, oh, shit. I said, not too good, sir. I said, not too good. He said, Harold, you got to get them books, son. He said, look, your education is going to carry you much further than football, basketball, or baseball. And by that time, we get to Westmoreland Circle. They let me out the car. And I catch the bus home by myself, stop, get a little tab and hamburger. And the next week, man, you know, I stayed out there late, and he came out there asking for me. So I started catting for him, man, whenever they would show up, you know. And we became great friends, man. And see, this man knew some sports, Butch. Because I tell you, if he hadn't become president, he would have become a sports talk show host. He would have become a sports writer because he loves sports. And I didn't realize that he tried to play football when he was in college. I can't even think of the college. But he was a wide receiver. He was an end, you know. I don't know if he was that good or not, but he was an end. But what happened, man, when 1958 rolled around and he was getting ready to go out of the country, and I was supposed to be graduating. So when they let me off at Westmoreland Circle, he gave me an envelope and told me to take care of myself, go ahead and get my diploma and go on to college somewhere. So I got on the bus and I opened up that envelope. It was the first time I ever seen a $50 bill.
That was 1958?
That was 1958, yeah, and he left out of here, man.
That was a lot of money in 1958, Harold.
Man, what you talking, $50 bill? Come on, man, I felt like I was rich, man. So, you know, he went out of the country, and I ended up, you know, 59 going down to Winston-Salem. And then, Butch, I'm working in the streets in 1968 after the riot. And at that time, I was with UPO. And Peter Green helped me get a job at UPO because I had tried out. I'm chasing my NFL dream, and I go to West Virginia to play with the Charleston Rockets for a year, and they cut me the next year. And I had to come home, man. I got to go home, man. And I had to come home, and I run into Peter Green and Marvin Gaye at in front of the Howard Theater. And Petey's just got out of jail. I mean, I'm thinking, and Marvin had just got out of the Navy. So we talked and we hugged and stuff. And see, Marvin used to come to Parkside all the time and sing doo-wah under the streetlights. See, I knew Marvin from one day in the project, because he come to Parkside and Peasy Adams and he became very good friends. And Marvin, when I left Parkside and moved to Simple City on 58th and Blaine, Marvin, evidently his daddy had put him out. And he came out there to live with Peasy Adams. Peasy used to babysit for my mom. So Marvin and I had became good friends. And I remember one morning catching the bus to Spingarn, And Mama said, "Man, her, I think I'm getting out of here, man. I think I'm joining the Navy." And I think that's what he did. And I didn't see him again until I think in around 72. But anyway, getting back to Nixon, I run into Nixon because I'm working up in the as a roving leader in the U Street corridor after the riots. And of course, the riots was something else because my two partners at UPO Neighborhood Workers, Mr. James Banks, hired Petey Green, and Petey got me the job as a neighborhood worker. And Mr. Banks hired a third neighborhood worker, and that was H. Rapp Brown. And the three of us were neighborhood workers at Juvenile and Planning Organization. And Rapp was one of the most brilliant guys I've ever met. He's some of a smart dude, man. And 1967, the United Planning Organization gave a grant to the D.C. Recreation Department for roving leaders. I think he gave enough to hire five roving leaders. But they said, if we give you this grant, you got to take Harold Bell. So that's how I became a roving leader. Petey Green stayed with UPO.
Harold, excuse me, for the sake of our listeners who may not have lived in Washington at the time, and explain briefly what a roving leader was.
Oh, okay, yeah. A roving leader was considered an elite position with the D.C. Recreation Department. We worked on the Youth Gang Task Force, and we worked the whole city. Wherever there was problems on the playground in the schools, we would be assigned to those areas, and I was assigned to the Cadoza area. And so that was one of the jobs that a lot of people sought and wanted. It was very political, and I was in the right place at the right time and got that job with the D.C. Recreation Department. Rapp Brown left and became in charge of SNCC. He took Stokey Carmichael's place, and Murren Byrd replaced Rapp Brown. But Murren had already been assigned. He was the first SNCC director in 1960 when they started that SNCC in Raleigh, North Carolina at Shaw University. Murren was the first SNCC, and then behind Murren became John Lewis, who became the director of SNCC, and then Stokey Carmichael came in to replace John Lewis, and there were some bad feelings about that. And then, of course, H. Rapp Brown, then Murren Byrd came back. That's some hell of a history there. So anyway, Butch, I'm a roving leader, and I'm standing in front of Ben's Chili Bowl, and Petey Green said, "Harold, your man down there on 7th Street." I said, "What are you talking about, my man?" He said, "Your man, Richard Nixon, the president." I said, "What, man?" I took off running, Butch. I left my car. I said, "Man, let me go down and see my man." I got down there, but people were all over the place. They wouldn't let me nowhere near him. The Secret Service wouldn't let me nowhere near him. I said, "Man, tell him it's Harold Bell. I used to caddy for him at Burning Tree." One of the Secret Service guys looked at me and said, "Write him a letter." And that's what I did, Butch. I wrote him a letter, man. I came home and wrote him a letter and told him what I was doing, you know, since he last saw me, that I was working with Jungle, you know. And so, man, I sent that letter to the White House. I just sent it, Butch. I said, "Shoot, I'm going to send this letter." About 2 weeks later, I get a letter from the White House, man, President of the United States of America, Richard Nixon, saying how proud he was of me that I had returned to the young people whose lives once resembled my very own, and that he was so proud of me, and he wanted me to finish my education, and he said, "You know, stand by, you know, I'll be talking to you." Another 2 weeks went by, and get a letter from the White House again. He's invited me and my wife to the White House for lunch, and we go to the White House, Butch, and our pictures go all over the world. Nixon invites his caddy to the White House. And there had it, we standing there with William Rogers and Richard Nixon. And my brother was in Germany at the time, Earl, the one that ended up being a D.C. cop. He was a military policeman, sergeant, and he was a heavyweight boxing champion of Germany, man. And he saw my picture over in Germany, man. And he called home. Said, "Man, what you doing at the White House with the president?" I said, "Hell, he invited me, man." So that was a blessing in disguise, because, man, I didn't know the difference between a Republican or Democrat, man. I was just in the right place at the right time, and I went to the White House, and he gave me a job, man. I didn't know he was offering me a job until my wife told me, kick me. He said, he offering you a job. So he asked me what I wanted to do. I said, man, I want to go back into the community and help these young people. And that's what I did. You know, I found Bowling Boys Base on Bowling Air Force Base, the first juvenile facility ever located on a military installation at a Bowling Air Force Base. Of course, Judge Luke Moore, Judge Harold Green, Judge Hamilton, Harry Alexander, the Redskins, all of us joined all of us over there and cutting the ribbon, man. And hey, man, it's been a ball, man. You know, I didn't get rich, man, but man, mentally and physically, man, I'm rich, man.
Folks, we're rich listening to this history. This is a history lesson of D.C., and nobody that I know can give a history of Washington, D.C. better than our guest, Harold Bell. And Harold, it's often, people often talk about it, it's written, but you were there. And take us through briefly 1968, when the word came down about Martin Luther King. You were right in the belly of the beast, right in that 14th Street corridor.
Hey, Butch, it's funny you say that, because when they do the history, they never include me. Yeah, Butch, 1968, April 4th, I knew exactly where I was, man. Willie Wood, my dear friend, was my coworker at the D.C. Recreation Road Leader Program. Willie Wood would come home after the season was over with the Green Bay Packers, and you know they weren't making the kind of money these guys were making today. He had to get a second job.
Yeah.
So he would come home and teach, and then he got a job with the Road Leader Program. So that particular day, Willie and I had just had lunch at a place called Chez Maurice. You remember Chez Maurice?
Oh, absolutely. On 9th Street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's where all the in crowd hung out on 9th Street. So
right.
Willie and I went in and had a sandwich, and we came out, and we were standing on the corner. It was a beautiful day, man. We were standing on the corner, and everybody would come by. They would holler at Willie. Everybody knew who Willie Wood was. They hollered at Willie. And then my man Harvey came by. And he hollered out the car, "Harold Bell, they just shot and killed Dr. King in Memphis, Tennessee." Man, Willie and I looked at him and said, "Man, he must be crazy, man." And sure enough, man, people started coming out of Chez Maurice and telling them they had just seen it on television. And Willie Wood said, "I never forget it, Harold, boy, we in trouble. We in trouble." And he was right, man. All hell broke loose. And Willie and I walking down the U Street corridor, and meeting us was Luke C. Moore. Luke C. Moore was the first black modern-day U.S. Marshal. He followed in the footsteps of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass was the first black U.S. Marshal, and Luke was assigned to the U.S. Marshal in charge. And Luke was a D.C. guy. He came from, he wasn't born here in D.C., but he came here. I forgot where Luke was from. But anyway, Luke met us in the middle of the street. And the three of us walk arm in arm all the way down to Ben's Chili Bowl. We get down to Ben's Chili Bowl, and there's Ben standing across the street with our man, John Snipes. So Snipes sees us, and Snipes comes across the street. So Luke says, "What's happening?" And so Snipes tells Luke, they say, "Ben got to close down, man. They got to close everything down." So Luke goes and talks with Ben, and So we said, "What the hell is going on?" So anyway, I end up calling up to the D.C. Recreation Department to Stan Anderson, our boss. And Stan said, "Stan, what you want us to do?" He said, "You and Willie need to stay out there. Say, y'all may be able to save some lives. You know, everybody know you in that area, so you need to be out there." But before he could hang up, he said, "Tillman O'Brien wants to see you down at the precinct at 16th and B." Tillman O'Brien was one of the highest-ranking black officials in the D.C. Police Department. He was assistant chief, and he was a D.C. guy. I mean, he was officer friendly, all those other. He used to walk around the neighborhood by himself, and that's the kind of guy. And we became great friends. So I said, I wonder what Tillman want with me. So I go down to the station house in the lay, and the sergeant say, Mr. Bell, he's waiting for you downstairs. I go downstairs, man. There are all these cops, man, in riot gear. They got, man, look like they got their bulletproof vests on and everything, and they're all in formation. And Tillman calls me over, and he swears me in, but gives me a police badge. I said, man, what is this? I said, Tillman, what is this? I said, where's my gun? He said, Harold, I can't give you a gun. He said, you're going to be all right. You're going to be all right. Everybody know you. I said, look, Tillman, I'm not scared of the riders. You know what I'm saying? I'm scared of one of these scared cops of yours shooting me, think I'm a looter, you know? So anyway, he convinced me to go back out there. So I had to go back out there for 3 days, man. And that police badge helped me get through the military barricades and the police barricades they had set up around the city. And one thing a lot of people don't know what happened. I didn't realize that we had as many people killed as I thought. I thought we had this in the single digits, but we had about 12 people killed. But what happened is a guy named Patrick Murphy from New York, Bush. Patrick Murphy was the godfather of police community relations. And he was chief in New York when Mayor Washington hired him to come down to D.C. to take over and head the police department and the fire department, Butch. So Patrick Murphy came in, and Butch, what Patrick Murphy, he's a bad white boy, man. Patrick Murphy was called a meeting of the roving leaders and cops in different jurisdictions to meet once a month at the first of the month, and we were talking about what was going on in the community and how we would team up. And that's what saved a lot of lives. People don't realize, man, J. Edgar Hoover, who was, you know, FBI.
Mm-hmm.
J. Edgar Hoover came out and said, telling Mayor Washington and Patrick Murphy, shoot the looters on sight. And both of them said, not on our watch.
That's
nobody
right.
Shooting no looters on sight. And, man, that saves a lot of lives, man. And Patrick Murphy, and I said, I think I wrote a column, a blog on that a couple of weeks ago, that Patrick Murphy, Black Lives Matter. When he was in this town, Patrick Murphy ended up leaving here, and the police actually they ran him out of town, man. Because police community relations was working, Butch. The cops knew the people in the community, you know. They could walk, they could find out what was happening, and the police union sabotaged police community relations in this community, and Patrick Murphy left New York. But, yeah, that was the history lesson that a lot of folks are not aware of that took place during the riot. What was the real deal? That we did not go down to F Street to ride. We didn't go up to Silver Spring to ride. We rioted in our own community, man, and we're still recovering from that. You know, runners out of Washington, and the white folks, as you know, have come in and taken over.
That's right. Harold Bell is in the Coach's Corner, and I know you are enjoying this. This is a history lesson. And, Harold, we could talk for days, but we got about 30 minutes left, and then you have to prepare for your show, which I want you to let our listeners know about your shows. But now let's pivot to your great career in sports radio and television. You alluded earlier how it started. But take us through you and Petey Green and how that started, and then Bobby Bennett, and then your own show, and then Inside Sports, the original Inside Sports.
Inside Sports, let's start right there, man, because when I left Petey, who prepared me, laid the foundation, I went to Bobby Bennett, and then I went to WOOK with my man John Turk, Carl Ferguson, Cliff Harlan, man, you know, WOK, I mean, was it was black-oriented format, but it was owned by white folks, you know?
Sure.
So I get up there, and they get me in, and, I tell my wife one night, I said, look, I got this new show at WOK Radio. I'm going to have my own talk show. I said, I need a title to call the show. And that's when Holly get the words out of my mouth. She said, Inside Sports. I said, what? I said, Hattie, where you get that from? She said, well, you get all the inside information before the papers, the television stations, because you know all the athletes. I said, wow. So anyway, we named the show Inside Sports. So Derek Humphries was my attorney at the time. And the night of the show, he told me, Bush, I said, knuckle, I was a knucklehead, wouldn't listen. He said, Harold, trademark this name. He said, this is going to be a hot entity. He said, what you get ready to is history, man. Yeah, I ain't pay no attention to him, Bush. I said, I'm on radio, man. I'm ego tripping. I ain't got no time to worry about no trademark and that stuff. So, man, the show jumped off. And, of course, Inside Sports was changed the way that we talk sports in America and report sports in America, because my format was like nothing anyone had ever heard. It was just me being Harold Bell. See, the thing about me and these other folks that come into broadcast and sports talk, see, I was already a legend in the community. You understand? So I brought that with me to Inside Sports. And then being an athlete, you know, and knowing some of the athletes, nobody had ever heard. They always said, well, you can't mix sports and politics. Well, I proved them wrong. You know, I was able to mix sports and politics. I played message music about our homeboy, what's going on, respect yourself, black and proud. Nobody ever heard that, nothing like that in a sports talk show. Never done before. I did my own commentaries. I would go up and sit with my man Jim Vance in the evening, and I watched Jim write his commentaries. Man, Jim was right, man. Jim could tell a story. And he always tried to tell me, said, Harold, you gotta, your commentary's got to be a story. And that's what I started doing, man. So I started doing commentaries. Then I started holding sports media roundtables. I was the first one to ever hold sports media roundtables. I had, of course, Dick Keller. I had George Solomon at the Washington Post. I had Bill Roden. I had Larry Fitzgerald Sr., whose son is Larry Fitzgerald Jr. I had people from all over the country on my sports media roundtable once a month, man. You understand? I started all that, man, and it was a big hit. But it was just me being me, because that's the format that I brought to radio. And, of course, with TV had laying the foundation, see, a lot of people don't realize that Seven on Your Side, Bush, that came from Inside Sports, man. Paul Burr used to come and be on my show. He couldn't believe that the telephone calls that I was getting every week. He couldn't believe it. And people asked me about, well, how can you find me a job? Or how can you go to the school and see why this teacher is messing with my child? He couldn't believe that those kind of calls is that what I was getting. So, man, the next couple of times he came down there, all of a sudden I turned around, he'd come up with Seven on Your Side. And Seven on Your Side really came from Inside Sports, and really I got the idea from Petey Green, because Petey used to get those same kind of calls, but, you know? Yeah. So that was how that format went out there. And by me not listening to Derek Humphries, my lawyer, I got caught in the bind, because the Washington Post kidnapped Inside Sports in 1978. I got Dave Dupuy on my show. I got George Solomon on my show. Brian Rosen on my show. I got Michael Wilbon on my show. I got all these guys on my show, and Washington Post just takes my title, because they saw that I hadn't copyrighted, and took it to New York and published Inside Sports Magazine. Look it up. That's Inside right. Sports Magazine. But see what happened, they lost several million dollars because they didn't know how to transfer my popularity from my radio sports talk show into print. You understand? So the magazine failed, but they took my title, and now Inside Sports is owned by the Washington Post. So, you know, but that's how they do, Bush. They take from us all the time. And this ain't the first time. And then you run into your own people, and man, they ain't no help. They ain't no help to you, man. So it's been a hell of a ride, man. But Bush, when you start out, with Red Auerbach.
And that's
and
what
Muhammad
I wanted to get
Ali.
That's what okay. I wanted to get to, Harold. Talk about your relationships. I mean, you had many relationships, but see, it
yeah.
was different then. The guys now mm-hmm. make so much money that they isolate
right.
themselves from the community.
Right, that's
but
right.
But you
right.
were connected with all of those people, and it was nothing, folks, to see a Red Auerbach or Sam Jones or Jim
mm-hmm.
Brown or Muhammad Ali. Not just to come on Harold's show, certainly they did
be
that.
Be out in the community.
But Harold brought them down in the community. He brought them on V Street. He brought them on W
That's
Street.
That's right.
But please
uh-huh.
tell a story, you and Ali and that big fight over in Africa where they wanted you to attend, and you said, man, I ain't getting on no plane to go to Africa.
That's right. I ain't flying across no ocean. Yeah, I met Muhammad Ali in 1967. Up on Howard University. It was Peter Green again who told me that Ali was on Howard University and he couldn't go because he had a meeting with Jim Banks, the director of UPO, and I had already moved to Rogue Leaf, right? And God said, well, I'm going up there. So I went up there and there was Muhammad Ali, hundreds of students standing around him, boy, and he putting on a show, man. I said, wow, man. I said, wow, let me go up there. So I eased my way through the crowd and I got right up there, man. Well, I can look him in the eyeballs, man. He was talking, boy. He was talking. So he went on for another half hour while I'm standing there taking in everything. And, man, everybody was. So he got through. He said, man, this has been great. He said, I need somebody to take me on a tour of this campus in Georgia Avenue. You know, he knew where it was. So what he was doing, but he was really talking about one of them pretty little girls. He wasn't talking about me. So I I said, come on, champ, let's go. Come on, go with me. And so we started walking down Georgia Avenue. And, man, we got down by the bakery, Butch. And I looked back behind us, man. It was like a parade, Butch. Everybody was following us, and people were honking their horns, and women were getting out of their cars, coming over and grabbing and kissing them and everything, man. And it was a ball. So we talked, man, and he asked me, you know, what I was doing, and I told him I was working out in the community with kids. Man, his eyes lit up, man. He loves kids, man. So I said, yeah, man, this is what I'm doing, man. And I work with these two recreation partners. So we got down to 7th and T, and he started shadow boxing with some of the guys, man, and just having a ball, man. Sam Ketchum, who used to have Sam K's record shop down there.
That's right.
He went in there and messed with Sam. And then he went his way, man. That was 1967, Butch. I didn't start my talk show until 1972, and I hadn't seen Muhammad Ali, right? So now, Harry Barnett, who was an attorney, a graduate from Howard University, a white boy who thought he was black, he and I became friends, and he ended up representing George Foreman. So Jim Bethea, who was a sports columnist for the Washington Star, they said, man, look, Harold, we're going up to Cleveland. Muhammad Ali is doing a boxing exhibition up there for come on, go with us. So I told Harry, that's the Harry, I think I'm going to Cleveland with Harry and Jim Bethea. He said, okay. So we go up to Cleveland, man, and which I walk in, and Muhammad Ali is holding court. He's holding court, man. Everybody always laughing, and he's talking big stuff. And he looks over, and he sees me, and he hollers out, Harold Bell, what you doing this far away from home? And all eyes on me. He almost fell out. I said, he remembers me, man. So Harold Barnett and Jim Tate, so we go over there, and we join the crowd. And so now this is a hell of a thing here. More history is being made right before my eyes. Now, Don King is a part of this thing. He's putting this exhibition on for children's hospitals. It's about to close, and they need some money. So now Don King is introduced to Muhammad Ali by Lordy Miss Claude.
Lord
Bright.
My man.
Yeah, Lordy, your man. So now, as things are going on, man, and they do a little concert, Muhammad Ali put the exhibition on. He must have fought about four or five people in the ring that night. You know, it was just a fun thing. And so they did a concert afterwards. And so Jim Lethea come up and say, Harold, look, I'm interviewing Don King. In the morning, I'm going to have breakfast with him. Why don't you join us? I said, okay. You know, this is how brothers were looking out for each other then, you know. So I go, and we had breakfast about 2 hours. And Don is, I mean, he's putting on a show for Jim Lethea, you know. Yeah, man, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And he hadn't even been named the first black in boxing history. But he was so confident he was going to get it. He's telling Jim, you know, what's going down and what he going to do. So anyway, as things come to an end, Don King looked at me and said, Harold, baby, and that was 1972. What is this, 2020 book? Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to go someplace. I'm still trying. But Don King, against everybody's, Don King, against everybody's wishes, got Muhammad Ali to agree to let him promote his fight. And Muhammad Ali was the kind of brother, man, you know, if he could help somebody, especially in this sport where they never had a black boxing promoter in the history of the sport, he told Don King, oh, okay. And everybody went off, man. What are you going to, man, leave that nigga alone? Oh, man. But Don, but you know, this is Muhammad Ali, you know, and that's what he wanted to do. And so history was made, and of course I came close to Don, and me and Muhammad Ali became great friends. And then I started going up to the Poconos Mountains where he was working out. And then one day I told him, I said, he said, Harold, what you want to do? I said, man, I want to do my own television special with him. He said, okay. He said, come on, meet me in Chicago. So me and Rodney Brown flew from D.C. to Chicago in 1974, the summer of 1974. And we go up there, and Pat Patterson, his security man, picks us up at the airport and takes us to where they're working out, man. The place was packed, man. Little Jim had reporters all over the place, so we had to go in the side. So go in there, Muhammad Ali is working out. Then suddenly, you know, he just stopped working out, and he's gone in the back, man. So I'm just standing there with Rodney. And we talking, and Rockman, Muhammad Ali's brother, comes up and said, hey, Harold, Kent want to see you in the dressing room. So I said, okay. So I go back to the dressing room. He's sitting there getting a massage. So he got a chair sitting right in front of him. He said, sit down, man, sit down. I said, what's up, man? He said, well, I'm trying to find out what's up with you. Now, what do you want to do? I said, man, I want to do a television special with you. He said, okay, we can do it. He said, come on, I'm going to Zaire. Come on and go. I said, do what? You going to Zaire? He said, you know I'm going to fight George Foreman, man, the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. You know I'm leaving. Go. Come on. I said, Tim, I ain't going to Chicago. I mean, I ain't going to Zaire. I said, I'm scared to fly across the ocean. Oh, boy, he started laughing at me. And he was chicken himself, you know, he first started flying, you know. But he gave me the blues. He started flapping his arms like he had wings and stuff. I said, man, let me tell you, I don't care what you do. I ain't flying across no ocean. I'm scared. So anyway, we go to dinner that evening, and we have dinner. So he comes over to me and says, okay, since you're scared to fly across the ocean, chicken, he said, when I get back, after I knock this sucker out, that's what he said. He said, you're going to be the first one to interview me. I said, what? So, you know, he always saying crazy stuff, Butch. So I said, what? So anyway, Pat Patterson takes us back to the airport to catch the plane back to me and Rodney. I ain't telling that now. Rodney is not aware that Muhammad Ali has really invited me to go to Zaire. You understand? Because when Muhammad and I are talking, it's really just me and him. So I ain't tell Rodney until we got back off the plane in D.C. Boy, Rodney went crazy. He said, what? You ain't going? I said, no, man, I ain't going. So make a long story short, me and Roy Jefferson, his wife Candy and Hattie, we go down to Constitution Hall to watch the fight on closed circuit TV. Okay. And Harry Barnett is sponsoring, the fight. So we had great seats, but we sit up in the balcony. And, of course, man, I'm scared, Butch. I'm scared, Butch. I'm scared, man, that George will knock him out. He will hurt Muhammad. You understand? Mm-hmm. And I'm on pins and needles, man. And man, of course, man, when he knocked that cat out in the eighth round, I almost fell over the balcony down as Roy grabbed me. I was so excited, man. I could not believe that. But now, Butch, I'm home. I'm lying in the bed, and I'm in Suitland, and the phone rings. It's raining like hell outside, Butch. And I'm sleeping good. Must have been about 10:30, 11 o'clock. And Hattie said, he put me over by the phone because John Thompson, Pete Green, they'd be calling me 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, about but maybe about anything. So she put the phone over the way I was. And, man, I'm still asleep. I pick up the phone, and I said, who's calling? And the voice said, let me speak to Harold Bell. I said, man, who's calling? He said, let me speak to Harold Bell. I said, who's calling? He said, fool, this is the heavyweight champion of the world, Muhammad Ali. Butch, I said straight up in the bed. I thought I was dreaming. I said straight up, Butch. I said, hey, champ, what's happening? What's happening, man? He said, you still with that interview? Now, Butch, here's the brother just got through with the fight of his life. He flies into New York from Zaire, Africa. And the first thing he does, he calls Harold Bell. I'm a nobody trying to be somebody, Butch. He calls me. Can you believe that? And that, until this day, Butch, I still get excited thinking about that, man, that the greatest of all time thought about me when he got back to America. He didn't call Brian Gumbel. He didn't call Ed Bradley. He didn't call Howard Cosell. He called Harold Bell. That's right, man. That blows my mind to this day. So he said, okay, I'm here in New York. This is where I'm staying. This was Sunday night. Bring your camera crew up, and we'll do the interview. So now, Butch, you know, I'm working, man, but I ain't got no money. I ain't got no car. I ain't got no camera crew. I got to find something. So I called Rodney Brown. I said, Rodney, guess who just called me? He said, who? He said, I said, Muhammad Ali. Oh, fool, ain't no Muhammad Ali called you. I said, Rodney, he just called me. So Rodney said, well, what's up? I said, he wants us to come to New York tomorrow morning and interview him. He said, okay, what's the problem? I said, man, shoot, I ain't got no money. I ain't got no car, no camera. He said, holy Harold. He said, this is how God works. Sure, they were at PBS, doing a special for Black History Month, he and Will Williams. So he said, Harold, look, I got the car, Will Williams got the credit card, and PBS got the cameras. They picked me up at midnight, Butch. They picked me up at midnight, and they had the cameras in the car. And we started with New York. We got up there about 6:30 in the morning and went and had coffee and donuts or hot chocolate or whatever. And I went to the hotel and called Muhammad Ali. And he said, where are you? I said, I'm downstairs. He said, come on up. I'm on the seventh floor. And when we got up there, Butch, he was combing his hair. He was standing out in the hall combing his hair, Butch. He said, didn't I tell you I was going to knock that sucker out? Didn't I tell you? He said, look at me. Ain't I still pretty? And we went into the hotel room and set up the cameras, man. And let me tell you something, Butch. This Muhammad Ali, I don't care. You know how many interviews he must have done all over the world and in the United States, right? Find me one interview where he did one-on-one with somebody and had a black eye. You can't find it. I'm the only one that he ever let interview with him that he had a mark on his face. He had a left black eye, and you can see it on that camera. I don't know what kind of camera they used then, Butch. But right today, you look at that interview, you say, whoa, man. What kind of – and, Butch, this is 45 years later, Butch. And this interview is on the one. As you know, I finally got it on the big screen in the documentary part of it in November of 2019 at the Miracle Theater, man. And, man, I can't even say what I owe to this brother. Wow. I mean, I owe him, man.
Mm-hmm. Harold, we've got about 10 minutes left, man. This has been great. I know you have to prepare for your show tonight. But, man, two last stories.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a very profound ending in terms of a statement. And mm-hmm. I always use it, but I was taught by the good Oblate Sisters of Providence, Order of Black Nuns of St. Augustine's, that it's okay to use other people's material, just give them credit for it. And I've always
right.
done that. But I want
mm-hmm.
you to let our listeners know the origin of Harold Bell's famous statement of every black face you see is not your friend, and every white face you see is not your enemy. Talk briefly
right.
about the origin of that statement.
Yeah. Well, Butch, that origin of that statement, you know, sorry, I can't never forget that, man, that it's every black face you see is not your brother, and every white face is not your enemy. It started with Richard Nixon out at the Burn Tree Golf Course, and then took on from there, Red Auerbach, man, you know, Burt Sugar, you know, Angelo Dundee, man, you know, those are the folks, man, that who propped me up to where I am now. You understand? They're the ones that really propped me up, man. And, of course, just stop to think, man. You got Muhammad Ali in your corner. You got Burt Sugar, Richard Nixon, Angelo Dundee. I mean, then comes on, you got Jim Brown. You know, you got the people that I had, man, were unbelievable. Because I didn't have to go through nobody's agents to get to them. You know, call them at home. You know, George Foreman. You know, Don King. I mean, come on, man. Was nobody getting a high-profile sports personality to do promos for him, Butch, until I started that. No, nobody. You know, you listen to me. You know, you listen to my stuff. You hear them saying about Inside Sports and Harold Bell.
Sure.
You know, I got them to do that, man, and that's why I came up with that saying that every black face you see is not your brother, every white face is not your enemy. And the things that I've been able to accomplish is unbelievable, Butch. And you've seen the list. I've had 32 people come to me, I mean, who just had a job. You understand? I mean, they had no fame or fortune. That came to me that went on to become millionaires. For real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I stop and I look at that, and sometimes you say, damn, man, you know, ain't no sense getting bitter. You know, that's how we are as black folks. We don't help each other.
No,
we don't help
no.
each other. And as you know, I ain't never had a problem of introducing you to anyone, Sunny Hill. I don't care
You've
who it was.
You've always done that. You've
you
introduced
saying?
Me.
Always,
to...
man. Hey, this is my man. He want to interview you. I mean,
right.
I mean, look, John Thompson, when he couldn't win a game at Georgetown, Butch, when he couldn't win a game, I gave him 5 minutes on Inside Sports every Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Every Monday. When I became the first brother in this town to be a Nike representative, you know what I went to? I went up on Georgetown to get my man John Thompson to put on the Nike shoe and the uniform. He said, Harold, okay, come back in the morning. Before I could get back down to the Nike store on M Street, he called out to Portland, Oregon, and made his own deal with Nike. Cut me completely out. You understand? Sugar Ray Leonard didn't have 2 pennies to rub together. Thought he was coming home to a ticker tape parade after he won the gold medal in Canada. Thought he was going to have a ticker tape parade, got home, and the media gave him the blues for having a baby out of wedlock. He went in the house and would not come in or come out. He locked himself in the house. I'm playing tennis down in Anacostia one day, and I look outside the fence, and there's James Morton, Dave Jacobs, and Weasel Jackson. I said, what the hell are they doing down here? They don't play no tennis. So I go out there. I said, what's up, gang? And they say, Ray won't come out the house, man. I said, what you mean he won't come out of the house? Well, man, he done lost all his self-esteem, man, about the media giving him the blues for having a baby out of wedlock. I said, come on, man. He said, man, will you please go over there and get him out? Because he going to listen to you, you know? So the next morning, I went over there and knocked on the door. He opened the door with tears in his eyes. Man, I can't even say over the phone what I think. Yes, I said, boy, get in there and put your suit on, put that gold medal around your neck, and come on, go with me. I had called Mr. Cousins up at Harrison Elementary, Bush, and I told Mr. Cousins, look, I'm bringing Ray Glennon up there. I want you to find a class that he can talk to. He just needs to talk to some young people. Why did I do that? Because young people don't get caught up in that player hating like us old folks. All they see is the hero, Bush. And when I took Ray up there, man, oh, man, he loved it, man. I started taking him to elementary school. I brought him on my show as a co-host. I mean, he couldn't put two sentences together. And we know where he went. He went on to become the first professional boxer to earn $100 million. And guess what? He never came back. John Thompson never came back. It goes on and on. I don't have to do that on your show tonight. But you already know the story. Those are the type of things, man, and the people that I touch, man, that I don't know. Something's in the water about us, man. I wouldn't do it. If I did it over again, I wouldn't change it, Bush. I wouldn't change it.
Well, one thing for certain, Harold, you never left. And
no.
The last 2 or 3 minutes, I just want to take time and thank you for being a friend and a mentor to me. When I first started in radio, my degree was in physical education. I knew how to coach sports. I knew how to teach sports, but I didn't know anything about radio. I knew sports, but you helped me. You lined up guests. You lined up reporters. And to this day, I thank you. And for full disclosure, you know, Harold and I sometimes don't agree, but we never, ever, ever fall out with each other. We always talk it over, and by the time I hang the phone up or he hangs the phone up, we have a clear understanding of each other. And I always tell you, I was brought up by men, my father, my brother, and people like you. And man, I just wanted to bring you on my show, this platform, for some of the people who may not be familiar with you, who are in Baltimore or new to the area, to tell your story. And boy, what a story you told them tonight. All right, we got a couple minutes, Harold. I always allow my guests to say, to parting shots. We call it wow,
right.
Words of wisdom. Yeah. Harold Bell.
Well, one thing, man, you know, I like so many people to thank, man, that were there, Sonny Hill, Roy Jefferson, you know, Willie Wood. You know, Bush, a lot of folks understand. I don't know no other sports talk show host or sports writer in America that has campaigned and got two professional athletes in their Hall of Fame when they were blackballed or overlooked. And I'm talking about Willie Wood, who I campaigned with Dick Keller in 1988, and got Willie Wood inducted in 1989. And then Earl Lloyd, as you know, pioneered first black to play in the NBA. Some for reason they overlooked him. And I got a Red Auerbach, my partner, and I got Congressman John Lewis to come in and co-chair a tribute to Earl during NBA All-Star Week in 2000, and Earl was finally inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2003. And I just want to thank, man, please, as we go out of here, because they have given me a chance to smell the flowers, and that's the National Association of Black Journalists.
Yes.
For giving me the 2020 Pioneer Award. I never thought that I would get that from them, because I've been on their case for 4 decades. You know, enough of them have not stepped up through the podium, man, and raise the hell that we need for the media to do that. So, I mean, I would just want to thank them, because they could have easily bystepped me. I want to thank my man Dave Aldridge. I want to thank Ron Thomas, who I've been knowing for decades, and Ron Richardson. They not only singled me out, but Lee Elder, Mari Wills are part of that. Were part of that. Charlie Neal. It was about 8 of us, man, that they honored a couple of weeks ago. So thanks for allowing me to smell the flowers. I never thought I would get that award. That's a national award where the local people here in D.C., they don't want to put me in none of their Hall of Fame, because that's the kind of player hating that we got going on in our community, but we always want to point the fingers at the white man, not the white man. It's us that got to get our act together, and we cannot expect Joe Biden to rescue us. We got to rescue ourselves. So I just want to thank you, Butch, for taking time out tonight to allow me, man, to be a part of this show. And hopefully that someone has learned something from it. Because we got such a great history, man. It's a shame that it's being suppressed because we got this, like I said, we got this player hating going on. We don't like each other. You understand? We don't like each other. And that's how some of the white folks don't like us. No, we don't like ourselves. So, Butch, thanks again, man.
Well, thank you. And, Harold, before you leave, let our listeners know how they can get more of Harold Bell.
Please
do.
Thanks. Yeah, I can. You can find me on blackmeninamerica.com, my blog site, one of the top 10 black websites out of 100 in America. I'm a blogger on there with, of course, the publisher, Gary Johnson. He's done a fantastic job. I've been with them for 10 years. I was with Bleacher Report when they first started out. I was one of the number one writers. But as soon as they started paying the white boys, they wanted to censor me. So, you know, I just want to say that. And also, I'm on Facebook Live every night at 9 o'clock from 9 to 10. And sometimes I do it like my radio show. I don't know what I'm going to do up till the last minute. But I'm having fun doing that, and it's keeping hope alive, man, and reaching back and trying to help somebody as folks once helped me. So thank you again, Butch.
Thank you. And, folks, that was the legendary, the pioneer, Harold Bell. I know you enjoyed this. This was a tremendous history lesson. But tomorrow night, tune in at 7 p.m., where we will have Emmanuel Barris out of Wilson High School, was the last player from the D.C. public schools to make the major leagues. He played with the San Francisco Giants, Philadelphia Phillies, Washington Nationals, and currently is the batting coach for the Dodgers AAA affiliation. Emmanuel Barris comes in the coach's corner. I want to thank Horton's Funeral Service for making this show possible. They're located 600 Kennedy Street Northwest, and their number is 202-829-9000. And yes, that was Mr. Randolph Horton and Horton's Funeral Services officiating the ceremony yesterday of Congressman John Lewis. Also, I want to thank my super producer, Rick Hampton Sr. Hey, visit theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com, theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com. You will hear tonight's interview as well as previous shows on theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Well, folks, hope you enjoyed tonight's show. I know you did. And tomorrow night, Emmanuel Barris visits in the Coach's Corner. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. And we'll see you next time.
You'll listen to a 30